evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. With 63 days to the election, activists are putting their efforts into high gear to get the vote out across this country. Here in the Bay Area, Democratic activists have set their sights not on local races, but on down-ballot measures in swing states across the country. Later in this hour, we'll hear from members of Indivisible, Sister District, and Airlift, three organizations looking to harness local dollars and volunteers in state elections nationwide. We'll also be hearing from local musician and songwriter Andrew St. James, who's found a way to bring live music to listeners. But first, as local protests around the shooting of Wisconsin resident Jacob Blake continue and the COVID-19 pandemic continues to wear us all down, we're talking to Chronicle columnist Otis Taylor Jr. about protests, pandemics, and how we are faring. Welcome back, Otis Taylor Jr., to City Visions.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So last Tuesday, during protests in Kenosha, Wisconsin, over the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a 27-year-old white man, a 17-year-old white man, later identified as Kyle Rittenhouse, shot and killed two protesters and injured a third, and protests across the country continue. And Wisconsin, a swing state, has become a flashpoint for President Trump. And in your most recent column in the Chronicle, you said that we're witnessing a battle over America. One side is fighting for equality and all races to be treated equally and fairly, and the other side is fighting for white supremacy, and they have a president in the White House, and it seems the police on their side. Tell us what brought you to write that and how you see this moment given all that's happened in the last few months.
So it goes back to a couple years ago, when Berkeley was the epicenter of protests in this country, when conservatives and supporters of the president were championing free speech. That's when Milo and Ann Coulter were trying to come. And I felt that their rhetoric was only meant to incite. But seeing the sides approach each other, coming to Berkeley armed with, you know, everything from pipes to bats to sticks to knives, I believe I wrote back then that someone was going to die sooner or later. And we had it happen in Wisconsin. But what really struck me was that this seemingly white person with a gun slung around his body just walks right past the police who are investigating a shooting, who are responding to a shooting. And they know, police know how volatile that city is right now because a black man was shot in the back 7 times. And the police didn't think to stop the person they saw with a gun. And to me, that shows America, also policing in America, because we know that if that was a person of color, especially a black man, that man wouldn't have been allowed to keep walking. That man wouldn't have gone home to be arrested the following day. It just showed me that what we're seeing out on the streets is a microcosm of what's happening in cities across this country. And I really want to have that discussion about it.
And how do you put the events that we just talked about and the events last night in Portland into context when this is days, literally days after the Republican National Convention?
Sure.
There's a connection there, I presume?
Well, I don't know if there's so much a connection as a disconnect. Because at the RNC, race was barely mentioned. And when it was, Nikki Haley says that America isn't a racist country. And that's so far from the truth, but that is the message the Republicans are pushing forward. And you have people in the streets right now who are pushing against systemic racism, against police brutality. And you have people coming to counter protest armed with weapons. What do you think is going to happen when those sides clash? And those clashes It's not over. I mean, you mentioned at the top of the hour that, 63 days from the election? I mean, just think what happens as we get closer to the election. Just think what happens if the president is reelected. It's not done. This is the beginning.
And so what do you make of the response from the Biden campaign today? Do you feel like it was forceful enough at challenging the law and order rhetoric that President Trump trumpeted over and over again last week?
Trumpeted. I like it. So I just was talking to my mother recently about this, and I think she's actually listening, about the Biden campaign. I feel lukewarm about his response today, particularly because he brought up looting and rioting as if the looting and rioting isn't a response to the shooting of black men in this country. If Jacob Blake had not been murdered, had not been shot, I'm sorry. At this point, it seems like every other week there's a new video that I'm watching on my phone of a black man or a person of color being shot and killed, police violence. But if Jacob Blake had not been shot 7 times in the back, those people would not have been out in the street in Wisconsin. So you cannot address the looting and the rioting unless you address the police brutality. And that's been the point for decades now. I mean, going back to the 60s, the Kerner Commission produced a report that basically said that if you don't want to have social unrest in your cities, then you need to do this, provide opportunities to these communities that have been disenfranchised in this country since slavery. That hasn't happened yet.
So why do you think it's so difficult for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to take command of this narrative? Is it because they're speaking about or around race while Trump and his supporters are just avoiding the topic altogether?
Yes. And that's been the problem with politics in this country, is the complete avoidance of the racial discussion. You look at so many institutions in this country and you see racial disparities. And I think we will get over the hump if we start, one, acknowledging those disparities exist, but two, start addressing them with meaningful discussions. I feel that right now we want to get to a place where there's not this unrest over race in this country. But I don't think that place exists any longer. Like, we can't reverse to where we were before George Floyd, before the pandemic. We are here now, and there's more and more people that have joined the rallying cry to address this. And it's incumbent on our politicians to do something more than lip service, to make an appearance at a march. We need legislation. We need policies to really address the deep, deep systemic issues in society.
So what do Biden and Harris need to say and do right now? I mean, policy will come later, obviously, should they be elected. But what should they do right now to take command of this?
That's an interesting question. I think what would help folks who are decidedly supporting Biden Harris but hesitant about the policies that don't act in office, I think it would behoove them to say that race is going to be front and center of our administration. For instance, it's not going to take another death, like, say, Breonna Taylor, for it to become an issue again. Like, no, from day one, this is our response to it. The fact of the matter is that it's not just in policing. It's not just in incarceration. I mean, here in the Bay Area, homelessness, how are people of color disproportionately represented in our homeless populations. What does that say?
And so is the strategy here to name and center race without concern for who Biden and Harris might turn off? What's the right strategy here from your point of view?
Well, I want to unpack that. What do you mean by turn off? What do you mean by turn off?
Well, I think that there could be, depending on what their aim is in terms of who they're trying to engage, if they're trying to, if they make this about racial disparities, and that somehow doesn't sit right with people, that could sort of feed into the narrative of that there's a whole swath of America that the Democrats are not interested in taking care of, and potentially could backfire on them.
I see that. From where I sit, I'm unconcerned about turning off people because that sounds like placating. It sounds like tiptoeing instead of here, person who, you know, wants a better country, wants a better world. To get there, we have to do this because we haven't done right by communities of color ever. You know, the president says he's doing a criminal justice reform bill. It doesn't do what he says it's doing. We don't need any more of that. We don't need any of the surface level policy that doesn't actually improve the health, education, and financial outcomes of people of color who have been impoverished for so long in this country. I think that would be a legacy for any politician. If you produced an effort that had a resounding impact on people's lives, I don't see what's so wrong about that. Maybe it's in actual messaging, but helping one another, how is that negative? How is that something that will torpedo your campaign when it's as simple like, I want to help people who haven't been helped? I just don't understand how that can be construed as wrong.
I agree with you. I think the issue is ultimately how is that message put out there in a way that is clear and convincing. And the question is, what are the potential trade-offs? And I don't think there's a perfect answer to that question, but it does, as I see counter protesters now coming to the streets, the question then becomes sort of who's in play here in terms of voters as each side's rhetoric gets more clarified. So before we end our segment, and I wish we had more time, actually, because there's lots to talk about. I wanted to switch gears a little bit, perhaps, but adjacent to what we've just been talking about, and talk about the impact that the death of Chadwick Boseman has had, it seems, on people. We learned that he died of colon cancer at age 43. He's had notable roles in many movies. And of course, last night, Black Panther was played on ABC, and it had like the highest ratings of since who knows when. Why do you think Boseman's death has hit us so hard?
Well, for me, it struck a personal chord because I moved to the Bay Area from South Carolina. Boseman is a South Carolinian. He was born in Anderson, and it just hit really hard because from South Carolina, not many people reached the heights that he achieved. But I think in a larger sense, starting with Black Panther, for so long in Hollywood, Black characters were caricatures, or they were villains, or they were drug dealers, prostitutes, or they were loud and obnoxious. Hollywood has never allowed Black people just to exist as Black people. Black Panther showed what Black excellence could be on the big screen. And I think he handled his role of a king with such grace and such compassion. And we're talking about politics right now, and what we're seeing from the federal government now is the opposite of compassion. And I think ultimately Bozeman and Wesley Morris in the New York Times, his appraisal picked it out. He was a historian. He did these roles, Thurgood Marshall, Jackie Robinson, James Brown. He did these roles of prominent Black people in history, and he did it with such grace. And I think that was his ultimate talent. And, you know, how many years did he have left of acting and giving us such strong performances? So that is why he'll be missed.
Well, Otis Taylor Jr., I thank you for joining me this evening, as you have on other evenings. And we hope to bring you back and have some more time to talk.
Oh, yeah. Got an election coming up. Thanks a lot, man.
All right. Otis Taylor Jr. is columnist with the San Francisco Chronicle. And coming up, how are local Bay Area activists working to change the course of down ballot elections across the country? We'll hear from leaders from Sister District, Airlift, and Indivisible East Bay on their efforts to bring out the Democratic vote nationwide. This is City Visions. Stay with us. Welcome back to City Visions. I'm Joseph Pace. As Donald Trump ramps up the rhetoric in the presidential race, which takes place in 63 days, Democratic activists are looking not only to take back the White House, but to flip other races as well. 33 Senate seats, hundreds of House seats, and the control of 86 state legislative chambers hang in the balance this November. Local Bay Area activists are not leaving anything up to chance as they try to harness local dollars and local volunteers to help turn out the vote. Tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by leaders of three organizations working to get out that vote. We're joined by Lala Wu, co-founder of Sister District. Welcome, Lala.
Great to be here.
We're also joined by Nancy Latham, member of the Governance Committee with Indivisible East Bay and volunteer coordinator for Team Vote Save America. Welcome, Nancy. And Nancy, please unmute yourself. Hey, Nancy.
Hi there. Sorry. Thanks, Joseph. Glad to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Renee Lindy, co-leader of Airlift. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you for having me.
And as this segment is all about activist and voter participation, we would love you, our listeners, to participate in this conversation. You could dial us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Are you volunteering on a race? Are you thinking in these last 60 days or so how you can get involved? Well, let us know what your questions are for our guests. 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email at cityvisions@kalw.org. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So I wanted to turn to you, Lala, first. What motivated you to leave a career in 2016 and dedicate yourself to creating Sister District? What was your tipping point?
Thanks so much, Joseph. So I don't like to do this, but if you can remember, think back to a dark day in November 2016, you know, you could probably recall how you felt on that day. It was scared, horrified, sad, angry. And one thing that my co-founders and I felt really distinctly was this sense of helplessness. You know, how could it be that we live here in the Bay Area that's so rich with resources and energy and passion, yet we couldn't figure out how to move the national needle? We didn't know what to do. We also looked around and saw that we won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, and that Democrats are the majority in this country, yet we didn't have any power over any of the branches of government. So how could that be? We looked around and we looked for the reasons why, and we saw so many. We saw voter suppression, fake news, the Electoral College. But one that really stood out to us was gerrymandering. And the reason that it did was because we can do something about it. It's very tangible and fixable by ordinary people. So, of course, gerrymandering is the practice of politicians manipulating district lines to favor their own political party or in-group to the detriment of other groups, other parties. And it has really unfair results. For example, in North Carolina, where Trump won only about 50% of the vote, there are actually, of the 13 congressional representatives, 10 of them are Republicans and 3 are Democrats. Now, that's not the kind of 50-50 representation you would expect in a 50-50 state. Just as another quick example, in the blue stronghold of Austin, Texas, there are 5 congressional seats there, but only one of them is held by a Democrat. And this is the kind of imbalance that you see because of gerrymandering. So the good news is that in most states, it's the state legislature that controls redistricting. And that's why Sister District focuses exclusively on state legislative races and driving support towards them. And in this year, we've got a particular focus on states where the state legislature controls redistricting. Of course, this is a once in a decade opportunity. It's our last chance in a full decade in 10 years to elect good state legislators who will redraw these district lines. And
based on the census results from this year.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, of course, you know, the presidential election is of existential importance. But as you mentioned, there are so many other races that we need to be paying attention to as well. And redistricting, I would argue, is the most important aspect of what's on the ballot. And we have to get these state legislative elections right. The Republicans destroyed us in 2010. I can go into that more, but, you know, I'll stop there and just say that I didn't know all of this at the beginning when I and my co-founder started this organization. I was an environmental attorney at a law firm here in San Francisco. I went to Cal for law school, go Bears, and you know, was well on my way to having a very different career. But the 2016 election happened, and you know, I'm sure like many of us, really shook me to my core. And our founding story is one where 5 women, all new to politics, came together. And I think we were all strangers at that time too, which is an interesting aspect of this. We found each other on Facebook, friends of friends, and then we started building something from the ground up. It was really incredible, and we would not have believed you if you told us that 6 months after founding this organization in November 2016, we'd all have quit our jobs, our other careers to lead this full time. So it's been a wild ride, and we've never looked back.
And I want to switch to Renee Lindy, co-leader of Airlift. So tell us about the origin story of Airlift and how you got to be involved.
Well, Airlift was started by a long-term grassroots organizer and activist called Danny Altman. And he looked around after the 2016 election at was there any way to easily have people that wanted to give to grassroots groups that were truly engaged at the community level and to be able to give to a highly vetted set of these grassroots groups? And there wasn't. So he set about forming Airlift, and he worked with a lot of movement builders across the country that were highly knowledgeable about what grassroots groups do. And so he formed Airlift, and I found out about Airlift in 2019, actually. I was doing a lot of phone banking, canvassing for the midterms, and I realized that I I wasn't going to be in those areas for the long term. And so I knew that there was a better way for me to spend my energy and my money. And I found out about Airlift, we are funding 17 groups in the battleground states for the presidency, the Senate, and protecting vulnerable congressional seats here in California. So it's a very strategic way for me to give my time and for me to give my money and know that I'm going to have the maximum amount of impact for the effort and the money that I'm contributing.
And let's turn to you next, Nancy Latham, with Indivisible East Bay. So Indivisible East Bay is just one of thousands of groups nationwide. And as I understand it, Indivisible started as a guide to resist the Trump agenda. And obviously now it's turned towards the election. Tell us about the journey you've taken with the organization.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Indivisible East Bay is one of thousands across the country, and it did start as a guide. There were a few congressional staffers who had been around when Obama took office, and they saw the havoc that the Tea Party wreaked in really stymieing his agenda. And so when they saw Trump get elected, they thought, aha, we can take those tactics, but use them for the forces of good. And they saw a lot of people around them feeling desperate. And so they sat down at their kitchen table. I think it was probably around 18 people, I'm not sure, but led by Leah Greenberg and Ezra Levin. And they created a guide, which they never expected to become an organization, but it was out there on the internet. And I, in the meantime, had the same experience as everybody probably here that Lala talked about, the sheer horror of the election night. And once that election night was over, I was just casting around thinking, I need to do something. And because of my day job, I was friends with people who are in advocacy organizations, professional advocacy organizations, not grassroots. And I asked them, what can I do? And they said, donate money. And I'm like, okay, great. And I did, but I wanted to do something. And then when I found the guide, I was just crying with relief. I found it. I know what to do. And so I actually started a little group, Indivisible Oakland. It lasted for all of one meeting. And then I found other local groups in the East Bay. And then three of them merged and we became Indivisible East Bay. And then I think in either December or early January, we met at Lucas Tap Room in Oakland and launched the group. And we had zero idea what we were doing, but eventually we figured it out.
So what strikes me about all of your stories is that they are truly examples of grassroots efforts, that people who know that they want to do something, don't like the way they see the politics and the direction of the country are going, deciding to try something different and never necessarily seeing themselves as political operatives, so to speak, or people who are really activists. And so I'm curious, as you started to spend more and more time putting this together, what surprised you about what you learned about yourself and about what it takes to push and have energy and momentum behind a particular agenda? Let's start with you, Lala Wu.
That's a great question. So many things have been surprising. This has been a journey. As I said, us five women were new to politics and jumped right in and saw incredible growth at the beginning and throughout. We're now at 45,000 members across the country with over 200 active teams and affiliates. And one thing that has really struck me is that we are all organizers. You know, and whether we knew it or not, coming into this work, it turns out that, you know, your PTA mom is an organizer, you're a school teacher, if anybody can be an organizer. And what that means is someone who works with their community, recruits people to join the cause, and then helps everybody to row in the same direction. And in our case, the goal is to support these strategic state legislative candidates in key states where the state legislature controls redistricting. And the way that we do it is by raising money through in the before times, you know, people would meet at people's houses, have fundraisers, comedy nights, all, spaghetti cookouts, et cetera. And now in the pandemic, everything's moved virtual, but folks are still gathering, creating that community, still having those comedy nights, trivia, yoga classes, cooking classes, all kinds of things to raise money that goes directly to these candidates, as well as direct voter contact. So getting together on Zoom, then going on mute to make phone calls to voters in these key states. And, you know, it's been surprising how many people care about state legislatures and care about them in other states. You know, it's not the sexiest thing on the ticket. It's certainly not the presidency. It's not even, you know, as sexy as flipping the House was in 2018. But it's been really, really encouraging to see how folks really get it. You know, once we talk about why this level of government is so important, you can really see the light bulbs turn on. And that's been wonderful. And, you know, Renee and Nancy both work in organizations that support this level of government as well, and winning elections and then holding folks accountable. And it's great to see kind of all parts of the political life cycle represented here.
And Nancy and Renee, briefly, you both mentioned phone banking in your initial comments. How is the work that you've been doing felt different to you since you joined these organizations?
Who would you like to go
first?
You
mean in terms of...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, Renee.
Well, I was going to say, I don't do phone banking since I've joined Airlift. So I'm going to turn it over to Nancy, and then you can come back to me with another question about what's different about what I'm doing now versus what I did before.
Okay, sure. So, Nancy.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about phone banking. I have become a complete devotee of the work, really focused on it starting in the 2018 midterms, actually, but have been understanding increasingly how critical it is right now because of the direct voter contact methods that we have, canvassing, phone banking, postcarding, and letter writing. The most effective one is canvassing because that's the most personal. And then after that, it's phone banking because that's the second most personal. But at this moment in time, because of COVID, so canvassing really isn't an option. So phone banking is absolutely critical for all of this direct voter contact and getting out the vote. And I'm also a big proselytizer for phone banking because people, when they find out they can text bank or they can write postcards, they can write letters, they're like, oh, I'd rather do that because that's it's less scary. But phone bank is actually a way to create these very small, short relationships with strangers, which can be strangely meaningful, because when I reach out to people in other states to encourage them to vote or to sign up for vote by mail, or when it gets closer to actually turn in their vote by mail ballots or go to the polls, I really genuinely care about them. And when I talk to other people and do phone banks with them, I think I talk to them about creating that type of short relationship. So I always want people to know when I call them, I care. Like, I start with this really sincere, like, how are you? And I actually, in that moment with that one individual person, I really truly mean it. I want to know what's on their mind. I want to know what they're thinking about as they're making their decision about whether to vote and who to vote for. And I mean, you make surprisingly personal connections, and it's just a really, really wonderful thing to do. And for those who are interested in doing direct voter contact, I would really encourage it. And there's been not only a difference in the rate at which people pick up, I think this is anecdotal, who knows if it's true, but it feels like people are picking up more often in COVID times, and maybe because they're maybe a little bit more lonely, or maybe they don't have as many things to do as they used to, but people will be really willing to talk to you. And then also it's kind of easier to get people on a phone bank because they also may not have as much to do as they used to. And it's as easy as sitting on your couch and sitting in front of a Zoom, just like Lala was talking. And it's really a way to be social and to work together to save democracy.
That brings us to an email from Susan in Mill Valley. who says, I've been phone banking, texting, and postcarding to voters around the country since 2017, and have noticed that active groups are mostly comprised of baby boomer women. And I think actually there was also a article in the Washington Post about this at the end of last year. Yes, there are a few men who regularly attend, but the vast majority are women. And I'm happily surprised when someone under the age of 40 shows up. Do you know why that this is the primary demographic of activists in this space? Who wants to take that question?
Well, I think I can, from the reading Renee. I've done and from what I've seen in the past, is knowing the history, women have always been the activists, and you know, they are the organizers, they are the canvassers in their own communities. And that's what's so impactful. And the groups that we're supporting, those are truly the messengers within their own communities. They are going, you know, they used to go door to door. They used to, you know, they were meeting people at church and the PTA, but now they're doing it over text and phone banking. And possibly it started because women had, you know, in the olden days, had more free time on their hands. But I think it's something that we are so impacted by the policies and the culture and the inequities that I think we stand up, and especially in this time with watching the fact that we put a sexual predator in the White House, that to me was devastating, but it was also the most motivating thing that I could do. And I want to say from Airlift's standpoint, we do have a couple young people and they are just as motivated. So it isn't just the baby boomer, 40-year-old and plus, but that's obviously a population that has some life experience and possibly some more free time.
I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're talking to Democratic activists here in the Bay Area who are working on out-of-state races. If you have a question or comment for our guests, you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@KALW.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at City Visions, KALW. So, Renee, I want to stay with you for a moment because you've brought up this point about how Airlift is working to empower local groups on the ground in their area. Why that particular strategy for Airlift?
Well, because research shows that relational organizing is the most effective organizing, and local grassroots groups truly know the issues of their own community and what's going to impact people in their day-to-day lives. And by having basically neighbor to neighbor, talking to each other and relating, it's not just a short-term relationship, it's a long-term relationship. And they're going to be going back to potential voters 2, 3, 4 times a year before they ask for a vote or before they're giving recommendations. And even more important now, all of us are so focused on getting Trump out of the White House, but that's just step number one. We've got to be worried about 2022 and 2024, and these groups are focused on just that. They will be going and working within their communities, both in off-year elections, primary year elections. So to me, it's an investment in the long-term infrastructure in these communities and showing the people that if you show up and vote, you are going to impact your future and you can hold your elected officials accountable.
And how do you vet which groups to fund?
So we've worked with both national organizations like Movement Voter Project and Way to Win, as well as individual folks that have been working in the power building world for years. So we get recommendations. We have a goal, a strategy of being in the battleground states for the Senate and the presidency. And we want to be supporting organizations that are turning out people of color and young people. So we get a vetted subset of groups, and then we go and turn around and do our additional vetting and establish a relationship with those groups. And so when I speak to a potential donor, I can tell them from my heart that they are effective, well-run, and strategic organizations that are going to turn out the voters that we need to have to win in 2020, as well as in the next elections, 2 and 4 and 10 years from now.
And Lala, going back to you regarding sister districts, focus on state legislators as legislator votes races. You mentioned that, you know, it's not that sexy, but as far as I understand, it's part of the Republican playbook to really take over local seats because that's where the policy is made. That's where the district lines are drawn. So what was that like for you to realize that as a Democrat, you were trying to play catch up a little bit with how Republicans have been doing it for quite some time?
Yeah, playing catch up is exactly the way to put it. And before I jump there, I just want to endorse Airlift and its strategy. I mean, the importance of year-round community investment and community organizing, that accountability loop with the electoral loop is really, really critical so that we can break out of this transactional mode of politics, right? That's really, really, really important. And it's something, again, Republicans know what they're doing, you know. So when it comes to gerrymandering and redistricting, there was a Republican strategy called Red Map in 2010. This is something that Republicans implemented in full view, broad daylight. Karl Rove wrote an op-ed, you know, that this is what we are doing. We are going to go after strategic state legislatures in key states where the state legislature controls redistricting. And they did. Under President Obama, I mean, I miss him certainly, but one thing that happened under his watch was that Democrats lost almost 1,000 state legislative seats out of the 7,000 or so that exist in this country. So that was an incredible loss. And what it meant when the Republicans wiped the floor with us in 2010 was that they swept into majorities in all of these key state legislatures and they gerrymandered the expletive out of these states. And this meant that their Republican legislators had very safe seats. Everywhere else, the Democrats were packed and cracked into other districts. And so they were either extremely safe or impossible to win for Democrats.
I just want to ask you this follow-up question. If you are successful and you get Democrats into these state legislative posts, is this just about getting even and gerrymandering things the other way around to Democrats? What's your strategy be if you win?
Yeah, it's all about fair representation. You know, at the top, I talked about the North Carolina example, which is a 50-50 Republican and Democratic state. And that's what its electoral composition should look like. You know, state legislatures in most states control both state and congressional redistricting. So if there's 13 North Carolina congresspeople, it should be about 50-50. You know, it should be five and I can't do arithmetic. It should be even, right? As opposed to the 10 versus 3 that it is. And that's not fair. And we believe very strongly that once we get more Democrats, good legislators, people who represent their community into these seats, we'll have fair maps, which will enable us to do what we care about, right? Which is implement good policy. We're not here just because we want to get even or just because we want to win. I mean, sure, many of us, I'm sure, have a competitive streak and enjoy winning, but that's not the reason we do this work. That's not the reason we come back day after day and do what is hard and can be unglamorous. We do it because we care about the issues.
So this brings up another question, which is California went to redistricting not by politicians, but by committee. What do you think of what's come out of that so far?
Yes. So there is no perfect process, but California has about as good as you can get. California has an independent redistricting commission, which is selected from community members who live in the state. And it is a pretty good process that has very good criteria for helping to decide how to draw district lines. So one example is that it needs to keep communities You need to have good representation by the communities and kind of keep them together. And so you want to be very mindful of certain communities, for example, indigenous communities, black communities, et cetera, sort of becoming fragmented so that they don't have a voice. You want to make sure there's enough of them in certain districts that they get represented. And so there's a number of other criteria, and there's good independent redistricting commissions and less good ones. But here in California, we have it pretty good.
And Nancy, where are you focusing? Where is Indivisible East Bay focusing? What races?
Indivisible East Bay is focusing on a whole slew of out-of-state races. We are mostly phone banking we're also working with Flip the West, which has like Montana and Ohio and Alaska on the list. But we have created a team called Team Vote Save America, which divides into six state teams. It's what used to be the Blue Wall, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and then also Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida. And the reason that we chose those six states and the reason that we're called Team Vote Save America is that we are building off of something that Crooked Media created. Many of your listeners may know about Crooked Media. Their flagship podcast is Pod Save America, and they also have this project called Vote Save America, and within Vote Save America created Adopt a State. So those are those six swing states that they are asking their listeners to adopt, and at this point they have more than 200,000 people who have adopted those six swing states. And then we use their infrastructure. They send out an email every week to those who have joined and adopted a state, asking them to take an action or make a donation. And so we said, great, we are going to hop on board. And we created those six state teams. And as you mentioned, I'm captain of Team Michigan and Team Pennsylvania. And so we use their link to events, so we can find a lot of events with our states. And we have weekly meetings, and we have dashboards, and we have community building. Because, you know, as all of the organizers on the phone or on Zoom know, it's very difficult to keep up people's enthusiasm if you're not actually organizing and creating community. So that was the goal in doing that. So we had sort of a combination of the Vote Save America states and then some Flip the West states. And that is essentially our portfolio. And we're working in all those states to make sure both that the Electoral College goes to Biden and where there are Senate seats and other down ballot seats, that we are turning out the blue vote for those as well.
So we're running out of time, but we got a caller and I want to slip her in. We have Joan from Oakland. Joan, can you make a very brief comment or question?
Yes, I really appreciate what your speakers have to say. And I just was curious if they have a take on this thought that there's a very therapeutic aspect of activism. And I wonder if the speakers would care to comment on that, what they've observed. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much, Joan. Anyone want to take that for 10-second answer?
Well, yes.
Yes. There's research showing that is exactly right, that people feel so much better when they take action.
Okay.
And
well, in
that's
order,
my 10 seconds.
For those people who may be wanting to take action, we will link all of your organizations to our website so that they learn how they can follow and perhaps join your organizations in the 63 days and beyond to come. So I want to thank my guests. We'll have to leave it here. Lala Wu, co-founder of Sister District, Nancy Latham, member of Governance Committee with the Indivisible East Bay, and Renee Lindy of Airlift. Thanks so much for joining me and good luck. And next up, we'll hear how one local musician is coping with the closure of live music venues. Stay right here for my interview with songwriter and performer Andrew St. James. Heard 10th Grade, a song written and performed by my next guest, Andrew St. James, and his band, Fast Times. Andrew is a singer, musician, and songwriter who has been active in the local music scene for many years, not only performing, but also promoting other artists. With live music venues shut down, however, it's never been more difficult to be a musician. Isn't that right, Andrew?
That is right. Absolutely.
Well, welcome to City Visions. How are you faring?
I'm doing pretty well, actually. How are you?
You know, okay. Thanks for asking. So live performance seems to be in your DNA, and it seems like you found a way to bring your music to listeners live. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Before COVID, 2020 was supposed to have, I had all sorts of plans for it, as did everyone else. And when things kind of went south, we had to kind of reassess exactly how to move forward without shows, without the ability to go out and play live. So about 2 months into COVID, after sitting around doing pretty much nothing, a friend of mine, a promoter as well, named Ashley Graham, and myself came up with the idea of trying to figure out a way to safely bring music to people in a way where people will continue to be separated and safe, really. And so I want to say sometime in May, we went out for the first run. We were pretty nervous about it. Didn't really know exactly how people were going to behave, but luckily people seemed to behave.
So you brought music to people's front stoops, basically.
That is right. Yes.
How'd you come up with that idea?
That's a good question. I think it was really on the tip of trying to figure out what was safe, really. I mean, we had thought about promoting events at certain places and trying to separate people, but we kind of decided that that was maybe necessarily not the best way of crowd management. It seemed a little bit difficult potentially. And so at a point, we decided that, you know, going to someone's house where they can't really necessarily promote the event, can't necessarily have very many people there, would be an easier way of making sure people were separated.
So how's it gone?
It's going pretty well. It's picked up for sure. I think at first it was mostly friends, friends of friends. And at a point, got some television coverage and coverage on the radio, like tonight, and started to get hit up on my Instagram by kind of regular people, people that I wouldn't necessarily see at the shows I was throwing before COVID, people that wouldn't necessarily be out on the nightlife scene. And it seems to have kind of metastasized into something a little bit more powerful and larger. For instance, we'd be playing in certain neighborhoods in San Francisco or Oakland, and neighbors would come out of their houses and start talking to each other for the first time, you know, which is almost like community building as to just self-promotion.
And what's it been feeling, what's it been like for you to be connecting with listeners of your music, those who've, you know, who've drawn you there and those who are coming out because they're like, what's going on here?
Yeah. It's funny because on the regular stage, these regular stages, it's kind of hard to really make personal connections with people. And it's really, I've playing out so often and for years, it's easy to forget how much music means to people. And so one thing I'll say through playing to people in front of their houses, it seems pretty clear that, you know, art and music is still valued in the city, which I think is easy to forget.
Well, people have been paying attention. A lot of your recent music has had a reaction, has been a reaction to political times we're living with. And one of your songs, Making It Great Again, was featured on novelist Dave Eggers' 30 Songs for 30 Days protest playlist with artists that include Death Cab for Cutie and R.E.M. And I think it's also morphed into a Spotify playlist with thousands of songs for thousands of days, I presume.
Thousands of days.
So how has the current climate affected your music?
Oh, profoundly. I think it's affected me profoundly. Particularly recently, I think that with the drive-by shows, the biggest question, you know, we've kind of suspended them for the last couple of weeks, but we're going back into it. But because of the, in particular, the most recent violence in Wisconsin and all of the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement, really, particularly this summer, it's kind of put everything into perspective. And it's really interesting trying to figure out when it's appropriate to be like, yeah, like, let's go out and play for people. Is this still positive? Is this still good? And we find that it is every time we go out, but there is a line that's drawn. And I think that with all the turbulence and all of like the extremely upsetting things happening, it definitely seems to build or grow a little bit more of weight or importance to certain kind of simple things that we take advantage of before these things were happening, music included.
Well, let's hear a cut from another one of your songs from your latest album, Liberation Music for Boring People.
Take your eyes outside. You're such a wonderful mind, and I'd be erased if you fell out of place. I don't mind. It's been a colorful time with you, keeping pace.
So your bio says that you're an accidental child of a couple of Rolling Stones tour caterers. Tell us about that.
I was the accidental child of the Rolling Stones tour caterers, and I was dropped off in California, where I was raised. Both my parents were tour caterers for the Rolling Stones.
And that's as far as it goes.
That's for the story.
So your band Fast Times has been playing benefit concerts as well. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So before COVID began, this band had been kind of heating up. We hadn't released any music. I was with two other kind of local music stalwarts. Cody Rhodes is a drummer for bands like Geographer and a handful of other acts credited on Metallica songs, et cetera. And then Duncan Nielsen, who is a songwriter of his own right. We were playing My Parties at the Chapel and a handful of other places, and things were kind of looking up. We were going to go on tour for a couple months there in the beginning of the year. And obviously everything's put on hold. And so come June, July area, we decided to team up with Rickshaw Stop, which is the venue on Fell Street in San Francisco. It was the place that we were to throw release parties for the singles. We were going to release it in March, but ended up pushing towards July. And along with them, try and find local and or national nonprofits to throw benefit live streams for with each released single. And so this last one we did was last week, I believe. And half the profit, or the profits proceeds for the live stream, went to Rickshaw Stop, a venue that's obviously been closed throughout COVID. And then half of the proceeds went to Spread the Vote, which is a fantastic national nonprofit that is focused on.
Well, thanks so much, Andrew St. James, for joining me this evening. To hear more of Andrew's music, go to his website, andrewstjames.com.
Thank you very much.
And that's City Visions for this evening. Thanks to my guests, Otis Taylor Jr., Lala Wu, Renee Lindy, Matthew Latham, and of course, Andrew St. James. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was the mighty Damian Miner. Our tonight's show is produced by Jillian Emblad and Grace Wan. And we'll be off next week for Labor Day. Join us in 2 weeks. This is Joseph Pache from all of us at the City Visions team. Good night. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and get involved.
Baby, cold now, entrenched in your phone. It's gone beyond.